At the sound of the V-4 victory, the correct Eastern wartime, 2 o'clock.
The WIP Special Events Department, in conjunction with the Coast to Coast Mutual Network, presents the exclusive story of the Battle of Midway Island. This broadcast by three captains of the United States Marines is presented as shortwave from Honolulu, Hawaii, and transcribed here from the Mutual Line.
Aloha, fellow Americans. This is Owen Cunningham in Hawaii. From the Midway Islands have come three young officers of the United States Marine Corps, ready to tell you of the valiant job done by that service, whose motto of Semper Fidelis never rang truer than during those hectic days last week. Two of them are aviators who were shot down in combat, but not until they had scored against the enemy. The third commanded an anti-aircraft battery. Now, history is waiting to be reported. You know the framework of this epic. Captain Buckner, you had the best close-aboard view of the Midway area during the Japanese bombing attack. Will you set the stage for us?
As the Japs approached, we saw our fighters begin to engage them. Several enemy bombers went down in flames. About this time, we replenished ammunition, took a deep breath, and now we're ready again. It all began pretty early. Word was passed by telephone at 4 a.m., and those not already on station manned their stations. Mine was at the observation post of my anti-aircraft battery. It was still dark, but we could hear the big bombers warming up. We waited. We'd been waiting for 7 months, but this was real McCoy. In about 2 hours, we got word that the Japs were on their way, advancing in three waves. They passed north of the island, swung around, and came in. The enemy had come within range of our anti-aircraft. All batteries went into action. Between our fighters and our guns, we had reduced the enemy bomber force to 20 planes by the time they hit Midway. After unloading their first bombs, the Japs changed tactics. They started dive bombing both islands, peeling off and coming in steep. They seemed pretty methodical about it, but missed their main targets. Personnel casualties were light, too. We think our heavy ground fire was too hot for them. All in all, the attack lasted about a half hour. It didn't seem that long. It was like watching a six-ring circus through a keyhole. But finally, the Japs had had enough. They went out low, strafing a bit as they went, and rendezvoused out of gun range. Then I guess they lit out for those carriers that our flyers were attacking at that very moment.
Meanwhile, our flyers were hitting the enemy. Let's hear from Captain Merrill.
We got up long before dawn and went to work. We knew our heavy stuff, the bombers that were to have the sky cleared for their takeoff. So we went out to screen their departure and then skipped back to Midway for the next phase of the operation.
Which was
doing a bit of attacking ourselves. About dawn, word came in that our pilots out there had engaged the Japs. Off we went. We had just one order, to intercept their bombardment squadrons before they hit Midway. My division found them only 10 miles out. And when I say found them, I'm putting it mildly. They were pretty well protected by fighters. I saw about 16 Jap bombers with fixed landing gear winging straight for our base. They were the same kind that raided Pearl Harbor 6 months ago. I made one pass at the Jap squadron, and I sprayed a few bullets into them. Then suddenly I caught them from above and behind. At 8,000 feet, I lost partial control of my ship. On the way down, I was struck twice more, and the gasoline tank blew up in my face. When I saw I couldn't make the Midway Reef, I bailed out. I had heard that the Japs liked to strafe parachuters, so I didn't pull my ripcord for 3,000 feet. As they came down, I could see enemy bombs falling around the base. Lots of them missed. One whole row of high explosives made a sort of white dotted line along the beach. Then I was swimming. I had disengaged my chute and inflated my life jacket. And boy, the shore seemed a long way off. I finally made the reef and rested up for 10 or 15 minutes. Then the boat picked me up.
Meanwhile, your comrades in the air were pushing home their attack, too. People like Captain Blaine here.
I'm a dive bomber pilot, Owen. Our assignment was to take off shortly after Herbie's fighters and hit the Jap carriers that launched the planes that our fighters were then engaging. It was just breaking into one of those clear Midway mornings when we took off. We had almost 200-mile flight ahead of us, so we poured the coal to them.
What sort of orders did your commanding officer give you, Captain Blaine?
Concise ones. Intercept and destroy. We found our objective while passing above a fleecy patch of clouds at 8,000 feet. Through holes in this stuff, we caught a glimpse of the sweetest bunch of targets I'd ever imagined seeing. Three carriers strung out in a five-mile column, screened by cruisers and destroyers. Our squadron leader radioed our assignment, and I drew a keg at that carrier. One of the big babies.
Had the enemy spotted you?
Yes, indeed. We saw their fighters taking off and rising to meet us. Then their anti-aircraft opened up. It began to explode all around us, great puffs of it. We were tossed around like toy balloons, but weren't hit. We had to smack those carriers because they were bent on smacking Midway. We peeled off in steep dives. I was well in the rear of the formation, so I got a bird's eye view. One of our bombs burst directly on the superstructure of the Jap carrier and rocketed it like a hobby horse. Several hit alongside and probably stove in her plates. Enemy planes on deck took a lacing too.
Troy, this begins to sound like an episode in an old-time movie thriller, Captain. What next?
With the carrier smoking behind us, we started for home. Three of our fighters clung to our tail. I went down to 25 feet to escape any aircraft fire and shot from the Jap destroyers. The fighters would make a stab at us, wheel overhead, and then serve comfort. A stray shot carried away part of my fuel line. I managed to keep the engine flowing, the gas flowing to the engine, by working the wobble pump. From then on, it was a nightmare. Pumping, controlling, watching, and praying. When I caught a glimpse of our wings, I added another word. They looked like Swiss cheese.
Oh, boy. I judge your machine gunner was keeping occupied, eh, Captain?
He was working like a fiend. Then he told me he had been hit twice. About this time, I became aware that my evasive taxis weren't shaking to zeros. So, above us, there was a white cloud, maybe 1,000 feet up. Pumping gas like mad, I gave her the gun, and we made it.
You did, eh? Swell. And you finally lost the enemy?
Finally, none too soon. Either because I had pumped all the fuel out trying to stay aloft as long as I did, or from some other trouble, the engine quit cold. So I made my first water landing. We lit like a ton of scrap metal, but the dive bomber took it nobly and floated long enough for the gunner to climb out and for us to free our two-man rubber boat, emergency rations, and some float lights.
Captain, you mentioned your gunner. Will you tell us who he is?
I'm delighted to, Owen. He's Private First Class Gordon McFeely, United States Marine Corps, and a swell companion for a flight like that. Take it from me. He's 27 years old and comes from Yountsville, California. Right now, he's recovering from his wounds, which weren't serious, in the Naval Hospital at Pearl Harbor.
Captain, what happened after you got into the rubber boat?
Well, our main source of satisfaction came from the fact that Jap strafers lay 100 miles behind us, and Midway only 60 ahead. We figured our patrols would find us. We drifted. Our little boat had a leak caused by a Jap bullet. So every 15 minutes, we had to give her 50 licks with the hand pump. We floated for 2 days and two nights, pumping.
And how did your comrades finally pick you up?
Twice we had bitter disappointment when patrol planes passed fairly near us, but missed. Then on the morning of the 6th, we saw a flying boat. I fired a last float light, which sent out a long column of smoke. 8 miles away, the plane swung around and guided back towards us. She looked heavy and was, because her fuel tanks were chock full. Her pilot made a magnificent landing. We got on board. He made an even more brilliant takeoff. And that was that.
So you just went home, eh, Captain?
No, not quite. This particular plane was heading out on a daily patrol. She couldn't go back till it was finished. So McFeely and I spent most of the day as observers, hunting the enemy again.
Dick, in the final accounting, I hope that the fullest credit will go to such officers as Captain Cyril T. Samad, a splendid Navy flyer himself and senior in command at Midway, and to Colonel Harold D. Shannon, whose Marine Defense Battalion put up the mighty barrage that chased away the enemy, and also to Lieutenant Colonel Ira Kimes, commanding our Marine Air Group.
Credit should go to the Army Bottoming Squadrons under Brigadier General Willis Hale, too. Coming into Midway and accepting our operating conditions, they put on an excellent combat performance in completing coordination with the Navy and Marine Air Corps.
Yes, that's true. We fellows on the ground know that things would not have turned out as well if our air forces Army, Navy, and Marine hadn't hit the Japs so hard before and after they appeared at Midway.
Japanese neared Midway on June 3rd, hoping to launch an all-out knockout blow on that pair of coral atolls shortly after dawn on June 4th. They were roundly defeated during the ensuing 3 days. Combined forces of the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps dispersed the Japanese with heavy losses. All of them contributed much to smashing what appears to have been a major enemy threat at our vital island outpost, an invasion attempt. You will be prouder than ever to call yourselves Americans after you have heard from Captain Herbert Merrill, 28 years of age, of Arlington, Massachusetts. Captain Richard Blaine, 26, of Miami, Florida. And Captain Gene Buckner, 28, of Hanford, California. First, I shall introduce Captain Merrill, who informed me shortly before we went on the air that he became the father of twins a month ago. Would you like to say hello to Mrs. Merrill?
Yes, I would. Hello, Lois. I only wish that you were broadcasting, too, so this wouldn't be a one-way affair. Give my love to the twins and save lots for yourself.
That greeting was sent to this Marine pilot's wife in faraway Nashua, New Hampshire. Now we have Captain Blaine of Miami, the second flyer.
Hello, Mother and Dad. I'm delighted to have this chance to tell you I'm fit as a fiddle and not at all worse from my experience.
And here is Captain Buckner, commanding an anti-aircraft battery, who wants to say a few words to his wife and son back in Chicago.
Thank you, Owen. Hello, dear. The last snapshots of David are the best yet. Please send along some more. I am okay, and I will stay that way.
And that is a saga of the sea. You have just heard Captain Gene Buckner, Captain Richard Blaine, and Captain Herbert Merrill of the United States Marine Corps describe the initial stages of the Battle of Midway. They played a part in the making of history. This was their story. They've been talking to you from the studios of KGMB, Honolulu, Hawaii, USA. We return you now to Mutual.
And for word on events on this side of the Atlantic, we take you now to Washington. The showdown on minimum pay for men in the service may come in Congress tomorrow. At that time, the Senate is scheduled to take up the conference compromise of $46 a month, and many congressional observers are freely predicting that the upper house will readily agree to the new figure. At the same time, supporters of the $50 a month minimum are standing firm, and they claim they have enough votes to win out when the measure reaches the floor of both houses. Ever since the House of Representatives instructed its members of the conference committee to stand firm on the $50 a month minimum, a little heralded but well-supported movement to force final agreement on that figure has been taking place. And its supporters now believe that they have sufficient strength to force final adoption of the pay bill on their terms. In the original measure, the Senate boosted the pay for buck privates and apprentice seamen from $21 to $42 a month. The House upped the ante to $50 and refused to back down when its conferees came back with a recommendation to accept the Senate figure. The new $46 figure is the result of the latest attempt to reconcile the differences of the two houses. Another congressional fight is likely to take place this week on the move to abolish the CCC. The House has already voted against a $75 million appropriation for the once popular New Deal agency, and there is a definite move in the Senate to follow suit. However, Senate insistence on restoring the appropriation would not necessarily save the CCC. Should the upper chamber vote to continue the agency, its action would throw the measure into a conference. The report of this conference would still have to be approved by the House. And by its vote last week, the lower chamber has shown its insistence on ending the CCC's life. Some members are predicting, however, that the House might be forced to rescind its action if the Senate should insist on killing the National Youth Administration as well as the CCC. When these two agencies were up for discussion in the House, it was voted to continue funds for the former, but to withhold them from the Civilian Conservation Corps. There is a genuine belief that while the House might be willing to abolish the CCC, it will not do so if it means at the same time putting an end to the NYA. And the silver bloc in Congress is talking about forcing another 29-cent rise in the price the Treasury pays for domestic silver. The government already is paying more than double the world price. But Senator McCarran of Nevada plans to introduce a bill raising it to $1 an ounce. This would stimulate greater production, which McCarran claims is needed by war plants as a copper substitute. The latest suggestion in the movement to save rubber through gasoline restriction is that of curtailing the operation of taxicabs. It is understood that several methods of restricting taxi operations are under consideration. One would involve a flat order to make a certain reduction in mileage.
Another would limit the use to which taxicabs could be put. And a third would bar intercity taxi operations and limit the distance a cab could travel from its garage. It is said that sightseeing trips by cabs will also be prohibited. In areas where gasoline is rationed, taxis will be allowed only enough gasoline to carry out the operations permitted under their mileage allowances. Draft headquarters may soon examine the cases of 1,000 government workers who are deferred because they are supposedly indispensable. All of them are under 25 years of age. Senator Tidings of Maryland called the cases to the attention of Selective Service officials after his committee uncovered 5,000 other government deferments. The tall Maryland senator said that these abuses in the Selective Service system stick out like a sore thumb among government agencies, and he has demanded that draft officials make a thorough inquiry. Just 2 days ago, a Washington newspaper published a story about the 28-year-old son of an Ohio representative who was deferred because his job as his father's secretary is termed indispensable. Army men no longer need heap wrath on the head of the unfortunate bugler, because the Army has officially announced that it doesn't have a single one. The soldier whose musical blasts arouse troops in the morning is officially called a trumpeter. He blows a trumpet rather than a bugle. That explanation was made in listing the Army's 41 regulation trumpet calls. Less than a score of them are in daily use on military reservations. And so, for the moment, that's all from Washington.
Our final report comes from Mid-Pacific. Here is Jim Wall speaking from Honolulu.
And it's now 3:41 Sunday morning, Hawaiian War Time. The Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Nimitz, issued a brief communique from Pearl Harbor yesterday afternoon, announcing the defeat of a large and formidable Japanese invasion fleet near Midway Island, and since then no further details of the naval battle have been divulged. What actually occurred in the vicinity of that small mid-Pacific atoll is known only to officers in blue jackets and flyers, soldiers and Marines who participated in it. But the Admiral's statement was enough to make this a Saturday night of sober rejoicing in Honolulu. All Hawaii has been jubilant over what has obviously been a major naval victory, a victory in which a heavy enemy fleet has been smashed, with many of their aircraft carriers and battleships, cruisers and troop transports sunk or damaged, their aircraft destroyed, and a presumably large invasion attempt shattered. What are left after the three-day engagement are fleeing toward their island bases in the Western Pacific, pursued relentlessly by our own ships and planes. The tales of all this are not being made public because the battle itself is obviously not yet completely finished. And until it is, the Navy doesn't wish to crow about it. But Admiral Nimitz has already briefly reported the results and has indicated that it was no minor sea fight. He has stated that we have partially avenged Pearl Harbor. Admiral Nimitz is a tall, lean, hard, gray Texan, usually grim, not given to wasting words. He's a man of action, and when he speaks, he means what he says. Honolulu, which has come to know him during the past 6 months of warfare, realizes that he is so sparing of words that often he means much more than he says. If the Admiral saw that we've scored a victory, there can be no doubt of it. Though little has been said about it, the islands have been under a constant military alert for a long while, and everyone here realized that trouble was brewing. Volunteers, both men and women, stood ready for any emergency. The fact that details cannot be issued now about this and other battles should be no cause for grumbling by Americans here in Hawaii or on the mainland. The Army and Navy know their jobs and are doing their best. They want no information to leak out that might be of any possible aid to the enemy. Their censors are as anxious as anyone else to learn what is happening, but they're watchdogs of the press and radio and postal service, and they know as well as anyone that this war is not yet won by any means. We're on our way to winning it in the Pacific against Japan, as the Admiral said. But we haven't done it yet. There's still a long road ahead. Hawaii is ready to travel it, no matter how long it takes. So are the hard-fighting Army and Navy, who are grimly marking this morning of June 7th, a Sunday just like that Sunday 6 months ago today, when the Japs hit us unaware at Pearl Harbor. I'll return you to San Francisco.
And there you have a roundup of war news from vital world centers. John McVane reported from London, David Anderson from Stockholm, our staff announcer in Washington, D.C., and finally, Jim Wall, spoke to you from Honolulu. This is the newsroom in San Francisco. For latest news, keep tuned to this station.